Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
When Ishmael Bea's A Long Way Gone was published in 2007, it went right up to the top of the bestseller list, and I actually hosted his signing, and we had it at our Colfax store, and there were so many people there, it was hard to breathe, but it was such a wonderful... It was such a wonderful book that we all needed to know what was going on, and so beautifully written that when I heard he was doing a novel, I was very excited. And I think if when we all read this book, Radiance of Tomorrow, will just be, it's probably as breathtaking as his last book in the way that he writes. At the center of Radiance of Tomorrow are two longtime friends who return to their hometown after the Civil War. And in Sierra Leone, and the village is in ruins, and the ground is covered with bones, and as more villagers begin to come back, they try and forge a new community, but of course, there are problems and obstacles. And like I said, the book is described with gentle lyricism of a dream and moral clarity of a fable. Radiance of Tomorrow is a powerful novel about preserving what means most to us, even in uncertain times. As many of you probably know, Ishmael Bea was born in Sierra Leone in 1980, and he moved to the United States in 1998, where he finished his last 2 years in high school, and then he went on to graduate from Oberlin College in 2004 with a BA in political science. And he does such good work, so I want to give him the time to tell you about all he does. So please welcome Ishmael Bea.
Thank you for the wonderful introduction, and I also want to extend my gratitude to all of you for taking the time to be here tonight. What I want to do is to speak about how the writing of this book came about, and you know, some of the ways I tried to write, particularly this novel, in a deliberate way, the language that I decided to use. And also to talk about generally what I've been doing and some of the places that I traveled that inspired the writing of this novel. When the first book came out, A Long Way Gone, the memoir, I was traveling quite a lot, speaking to people. And I was also observing the media and also observing just what was unfolding in my country and other countries that are transitioning from war. And I began to observe a few things, which is that as soon as the gun silence, the bloodshed stops, the media and the attention and even sometimes the international aid goes to the next hotspot, as they call it in the international media. They say, okay, these people are no longer killing each other. There's no bloodshed. It's not as exciting anymore. Let's go to the next war. And so, but what happens, nobody really stays behind to look at how countries begin to recover after these guns of silence. First of all, just because there's a peace accord has been signed, it doesn't mean that people actually believe in it even. It takes a while for people to actually understand that actually this has happened, because most of the fighters are usually deep in the countryside, in the bushes. So they have to get that message through their own people, intelligence people, and believe in it and stop walking around with their weapons. Sometimes they will hide them first nearby their towns, and then slowly they will give them up. Nobody just says, oh, yeah, because they announce it on the radio, it is true. Because over the years of the war, people come to learn that you don't believe anything that you hear, particularly through radios or newspapers. So all of these, they have to believe in it first. And then when that happens, it takes time for people to begin to prepare themselves to return to their homes again, to their villages, to their towns, and start living there. They have to prepare themselves psychologically. to go back, because when they had left, it was not under good circumstances. Some of them had literally, their families had been killed as they ran away from their homes. So they have to prepare themselves. Sometimes they have to prepare themselves economically as well, if they can find the money. Other times they just show up with nothing. But people go back because it's home, because this is where their spirits rest. So they return trying to find a place to rekindle that broken friendship with the land again, to try and see if they can go back to the way their lives had been. Is that really possible? And if they cannot, what forms of traditions do they repair? And what does that say about who they are? Now, when people return again, the landscape has changed quite a lot. The way people had functioned is no longer the same. You know, when you go back, you have to start even from cleaning the bones themselves. You know, because during the war, when people are being gunned down, nobody's going about and burying them. So when you come back, you have to clean up. You even have to clean the houses where the trees and the grasses have grown, because the human presence was no longer there. You have, if the birds have to return again, nature has to begin to function even in this place again, because during the war, nature is afraid. So it ceased to function in a certain way because of what unfolds on the landscape. So all of these things I began to observe with my own return, and also with other people in Sierra Leone and other countries that I was traveling. And so I decided to write a novel to talk about this a little bit, to talk about the struggle that comes with that. So this novel opens with an older woman, Mama Kadi, who I try to envision, imagine my grandmother returning home. And she walks on the path and she goes back to this town and she begins to clean up, and she's joined by other older people, and then people start to come into the town. So you have former child soldiers that return. You have an amputated father with two children who have been amputated. You have a young woman who had been impregnated during the war and now has this child that reminds her of what had happened in the war, and she comes back. And you have two teachers who return, and they become friends, and one of them is trying to keep his family together. And you also have this difficulty where the older people are trying to bring young people back to the traditions that had existed, because this is what they knew when things were stable. So they want to go back to that, but the younger people don't know what they want to go back to. They have a sense of something, but they don't necessarily know what it is. They've been exposed to different realities because of the war. They've traveled outside of their country sometimes, some of them in refugee camps. They've gone to capital cities, so they have some sort of idea of how they want their lives to be now. The idea of power has also changed during the war. The dynamics between the elders and the adults and the young has changed, because during the war, a lot of the young people carried weapons, and some of them were sub-commanders, so they no longer really knew whether they could ever be able to be under the tutelage of the adults. So all of these difficulties, when people come, they're trying to learn to live together and to begin to form themselves again. And there are difficulties that come with that, that you see unfold in this narrative. There are even hesitations that are there. People flinch because of different things. For example, before the war, if you saw a young boy with a machete walking on a path, you only assumed this young person was going to the farm, to brush a farm or to harvest a crop. Now, after the war, when you saw that young person and you encountered them on the path, you flinch a little bit, because you remember there was another connotation added to this image. So you didn't know what to say. Also, if you hadn't seen somebody for quite some time, when you heard the voice, you hesitated to turn around and look at them, because you didn't know what condition they would be in. And by doing so, you took on that burden. They may be amputated in different parts. So all of these difficulties are there when the book opens. And slowly people learn to live together again. And of course, other newer challenges begin to befall them in this landscape. But in order for me to achieve all of this, I had to write it in a certain way, which is that I had to go back to use language in a way that I can bring people to this landscape so that they can see, feel, smell, hear, and be a part of the experience very intimately. So most of the way I was thinking about it was in Mende, which is my mother tongue. In Sierra Leone, we have a lot of languages, 15 languages and 3 dialects. I grew up speaking a number of them, and through that, you realize the language is very figurative. And also, I grew up around the oral tradition, sitting around the fire every evening, and the elders would tell stories. So there are certain techniques from that I try to bring into this novel. So when you read it, it's not some sort of conventional a novel that you've read before. The way I render certain sentences deliberately to show where you are, to keep you where you are, to feel the place that you are, because I believe that language fit landscape. If I were to write about adults talking to young people in Sierra Leone, in any African landscape, I will never say the adults said you guys, because that's a very Western usage of the words of the word. Adults would not say to children you guys. They would say children or boy or girl or boys and girls. They would not say, hey, you guys. So if I say, hey, you guys, you know you are not. You're somewhere different. You could be in New York or in Denver or any other place. So I'm very aware of this when I'm writing. But I also have the fortune that the language is so beautiful and figurative that when I try to find the equivalent of it, the English equivalent of it or translation of it, some of it is direct, then I'm able to get something that sort of refreshed the English language a little bit. And I'll give you a few examples. In Mende, which is my mother tongue, how you say night came suddenly, you say the sky rolled over and changed its sides. So when I write that, when you read it, you know something is a bit different, right? Now, also, you know, how you say, if you were to say, for example, that daytime has arrived completely, you will say either the sky has finished wiping the last residues of sleep or night from its surface. So this is pretty much how you would say it if you translate it in that. How you say somebody waited, you would say, you know, he held his tongue for the passing wind to speak. These are ways that you would speak in Mende to talk about what is happening in nature as well. So in this narrative, when you read, you realize that nature is also a character in a way. You know, it's not just an onlooker or a bystander. It also participates in what's happening. And it foreshadows some of the things that are to come. So I use a lot of these things, and this comes from the oral tradition, from sitting around the fire and listening, and also just from the language itself. And also sometimes there are certain sounds that are just part of the way people speak in my language, and I try to find a way to bring that mood in the way in this narrative. Sometimes the sounds are made to show time. If you are telling a story and you are trying to describe somebody running, you will say, he ran tuk-tuk-tuk, or she ran kuju-guju-guju. These are two different times that the person ran. Tuk-tuk-tuk means the person was running during the daytime. Because when you run during the daytime, your footsteps are lighter. So, and other sounds are occurring because of, a blacksmith may be hitting something, somebody may be cutting a tree, children may be playing or their bucket swinging in their arms, and, you know, the chickens or the cocks may be crowing. So you don't hear your footsteps as heavily as you would at night. At night, when you run, your footsteps are heavier because other sounds have quieted. So you can hear the kuju-guju-guju. If, for example, somebody walks up and down, if you live below them at night, you can hear their footsteps much louder than you would during the daytime. So the awareness is there. So when you're telling a story, you will not say the character was running at night. You will just say the character ran tuk-tuk-tuk, or the character ran kuju-guju-guju. Then you knew that which time it was, right? Also, when people, as this narrative moves into the capital city, you see the language changes a little bit. There are certain slangs and certain ways of saying things, but the way people speak their languages becomes more filled with English words. You know, if you're closer to the capital city and somebody was talking about a bicycle, they will say a bicycle. They will, in Mende, they will say, oh, yeah, a bicycle. But if you're in the countryside, people will not say bicycle. They use the word in Mende for bicycle, which is a sound. Because a bicycle is a foreign introduction into the tradition, so we don't have a word for it. What we have for it is the sound that the bicycle makes. And we have these very old Chinese, like Phoenix bicycles, and the bell goes giriginje, giriginje. So the name of a bicycle is called giriginje, which is the sound that it makes. So you have all of these things. So when I'm writing, always the challenge for me is how do I bring this mood, these feelings, into the words so that when somebody will read it, they will feel that they are actually there, sitting by the fire, listening to the stories and all of that. And also the oral tradition, one of the beauties of it is that, in my opinion, is that when you tell a story orally, because you're not relying on somebody to go and look at the book later on, you have to command that person's imagination, grab it and bring it to the landscape of the story and keep them there until you release them. And the only way to do this is through images, through using words in a certain way, through sounds and things that can keep them in the story so they can feel that they are there. But there are also techniques that were used when I was a kid, because when you're telling a story, you also want to make sure people are ready to receive it before you pass it on to them. So there are certain techniques that were used. When I was a kid, we'd be sitting around the fire, and the elders would start telling a story, and they would tell another story that we've heard many, many, many times. And during that telling, they would change facts deliberately to the story, and they would change even the rendering of it. And if no one in the audience protested and said, no, this is not how it is, they knew nobody was listening. They wouldn't tell you the new story. So if somebody said, wait a minute, that's not how the story is, and everybody would start arguing. And they would say, all right, we know. And then they would tell you the new story. The idea of story is also the fact that it has to be passed on. If you don't pass on a story to somebody, the story dies. So therefore, you have to find newer vessels to pass on the tradition and the wisdom into. So in this narrative, you see also how the elders are trying to do that, because after war, the population changes. Most of the young people are now in the capital city, not necessarily in the villages and the towns. So you have to find the right person that you can pass those stories on to so that they won't die with the older people. Now, even in Sierra Leone to this day, when I go and I go in the countryside, when older people will see any young person, you come around, they will sit you down and they will tell you as many stories as possible. They're probably thinking, okay, we got one. It's probably not, no one of them is going to come around in a few months. So we want to make sure this one gets the stories. So they will tell you, but of course they will make sure you want to. If you're impatient, they would not tell you the stories. Only if you're patient to sit down and listen to it. Another example I'll make with the beauty of the language is this. Sometimes how you tell time, when you talk about a person particularly, if you don't want to say, it was midday, you can actually talk about, describe the shadow of the person, because somebody's shadow determines what time it is in the daytime. In the morning, you can't see your shadows behind you usually. And then as the day progresses, it begins to move. It will move, and at some point you can actually see it in front of you. And all this, each point it is, shows the time of the day. And actually sometimes the cock will crow corresponding to where your shadow is. So my grandmother, for example, can tell you exactly around what time it is, when she would look at her shadow. She would just stand up and she'd be like, it's about time for this. Or she would say, the sun is going to be at the mango tree now, and you will look and you will see the sun literally sitting on the mango tree, the rays of it. So there are all these ways that are, that are part of the way I write. Now, what I'm going to do is to read a little bit, the opening of the book, and then read another, just to give you a taste of some of the things that I'm talking about and to introduce you to some of the characters. I'm going to start in chapter 1 and just read the sort of the beginning and the first paragraph. It is the end, or maybe the beginning, of another story. Every story begins and ends with a woman, a mother, a grandmother, a girl, a child. Every story is a birth. She was the first to arrive where it seemed the wind no longer exhaled. Several miles from town, the trees had entangled one another. Their branches grew toward the ground, burying the leaves in the soil to blind their eyes so the sun would not promise them tomorrow with its rays. It was only the path that was reluctant to cloak its surface completely with grasses, as though it anticipated it would soon end its starvation for the warmth of bare feet that gave it life. Now, as I was talking about, that nature is not just an onlooker, it's a participant. When this ends, you see that the path was waiting for the warmth of bare feet that would give it life. Because this is direct contact. If you don't live in a town, the grass grows on the path. It's reluctant for quite some time, but if it waits for quite some time, then it begins. As soon as you come, you start to walk, the grasses will retreat. So they know, okay, now we are no longer needed. And sometimes even in the wake of war, in certain villages, even an ant or animals will not even cross through the village. The birds will not be in the mango tree singing, but as soon as people return, they will come back. It is as if they too know that there's permission to return and that there's a possibility for life to begin here in this place again. I'm going to read another short chapter and say a few more words, and I'll open it up to your questions. Let's see. Okay. So this one is when a lot of people had began, the three elders are back in Imperi, which is the place where the narrative begins, the setting of it. And then this is sort of all of them coming together, and then as they began to breathe life into this town again and begin to summon people to return from wherever they could no longer rest. As the sun was stretching the cold bones of morning with its warmth, Mama Kadi and Pamoewa returned to town. They both noticed footprints that weren't theirs and became worried. As they whispered about what to do next, a voice spoke from a concealed position under the bushes. "The marks you see on the earth are traces of your friend Kainesi, whose words of greeting come from the coffee trees behind you." Meeting old friends had become strange. "I am now going to place myself in front of your eyes." He pulled his thin body from under the bushes, whose leaves had left pimples of water on his face. He was wearing a blue hat. He had found it on the ground somewhere and wore it to cover his head from the wrath of the sun. He removed the hat to reveal his much wrinkled face, the scars across it, and his skull. A young boy had slashed lines on his face with a bayonet and tried to open his head with a dull machete, proclaiming that he was practicing to become a brain surgeon. At first, Mama Kadi and Pamoewa didn't want to look at their friend, but in each other's faces, they found the courage to do so. They embraced him, squeezing him between them until he laughed, making the scars on his cheek magnify, resembling a second grin. "Well, you came out of this madness with an extra smile," Pamoewa commented, and they shook hands, their old warm fingers holding onto each other for a while, each man's eyes fixed deeply on the others. Mama Kadi wanted to ask, "How are you? Your children and grandchildren, your wife, their health?" As greetings were in the old days, but she held her tongue. These days, one must be careful to avoid awakening the pain of another. She placed a hand on each of their shoulders, gently releasing her friends from the stupor of all that had come to pass. She thought, "We are alive. We are here, alive, and we must go on living. Now I have two men to take care of me, two old friends whose strengths may equal a young man's." They all laughed. "We still have laughter amongst us, my friends, and hopefully some of those we have shared it with so deeply will return and we will be waiting," Pakainesi said. And the three old friends walked into the ruins of their town, the air sailing a bit livelier, waking the trees from their slumber and making a small tornado of dust as though cleansing the air for the possibility of life again. Now, even when people returned, the greetings had changed. Before the war, you know, I know this firsthand, and this has returned actually in Sierra Leone. When you saw somebody in the morning, it was not acceptable to say, "Oh, I'm rushing to work," when somebody started greeting you. They wouldn't just say, "Oh, how are you?" and went to, no. They would say, "How are you? How is your health? How is your grandson, your granddaughter?" They will ask every single person they knew in your family, and you will give detailed description about how they were. And in return, of course, you will do the same. So the greetings were very long. After the war, you didn't know what to do when you saw somebody because you didn't know who they had lost and how long they've been trying to make sure that they forget it. So by asking them those questions, you could actually make them even sad again. So sometimes you kind of met somebody and you just say, "So," and you kind of went from there. So you feel all of these things in his narrative, but of course it changes. Last thing that I want to say, and then I'll open it up to a discussion, to your questions, is this. These characters are going to challenge a particular central theme in this novel. There are lots of themes, which is one of them is how do you hold on, how do you move towards the future when the past is pulling at you? What do you preserve, as you heard in the introduction, what do you preserve the most in an uncertain times of your life? But another central thing, really, is these characters will challenge our idea, or most people's idea of happiness, which is this sort of, it is this continuum, you know, like you're happy constantly for like a longer period of time. What these characters will let you know is that happiness is not the absence of challenge or challenges in one's life. It's with those challenges, the ability to live life fully, to find those moments of happiness and celebrate them dearly. That's what it means to be happy. So you will see with the backdrop of all of this, they're able to genuinely love each other, to create families, to have a sense of humor. They go somewhere and they will laugh like there's no tomorrow. They will watch a football match, a soccer match, and they will debate things vigorously. And all of these things will go on even though they have these difficulties. So with that said, I do hope that the medium that I've, this oral tradition medium that I've tried to put in this written form, that you would read it and you would pass it on to others so the stories would live on. Thank you so far for your attention. I am going to open it up to questions. Raise your hand, it's an intimate room, and I will do my best to answer it for you. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for coming. And I'm a teacher, and I've been teaching A Long Way Gone for about 5 years. And I last saw you at Heritage High School.
Down
the street at Arapaho. And not only have we taught your book, but we also have watched the documentary Bling. And a lot of my students were particularly curious about how that resolved. It looked like you were trying to raise awareness about the role of diamonds in war, and also maybe to change some attitudes about diamonds in the U.S. Can you just kind of comment on how that ended up, and did you feel like you succeeded in doing something like that?
Well, what the questionnaire is talking about is a documentary that we had made many years back called Bling, A Planet Rock. It was, I believe, VH1, is that a channel? VH1, yeah. Think about the VHS cassette. VH1 that had supported it. And then we went to Sierra Leone. The idea was to bring American hip-hop artists to Sierra Leone, for them to tour the country to see where the diamonds are coming from, but also talk about the issue of violence, but also of natural resources. So I think what happened is that some people misunderstood what we were really trying to get across, where people became, it was like this either or for them. They think, oh, we don't want diamonds anymore, diamonds are bad. Diamonds are not bad. You know, what is bad is the way they're extracted and what it would do to people in that manner. In this narrative, you see that too. The population is split on what mining means to them. Of course, we want diamonds to be extracted from Sierra Leone because we need money to fix our country. So we want you to bling, put it in your hair, on your hang it on your, I don't know, on your winter coat, wherever. As long as you buy it, it's not exploiting anybody or us, and that revenue will come back and do something in the country. It's when it is, you know, sort of taken out during times when people are killed, hence the name Blood Diamond, or people are being sort of brutalized in the mines, and you know, to dig it, and that's when it becomes challenging. You know, so the idea that we were saying that for consumers to be educated about what they buy. So when they go to buy a diamond, they will ask questions to the person that they're purchasing it from. Where did you get it from? Do you have certificates that show that it's coming from a mine that's not supporting the war? And we hope that by asking these questions, the people that are the sellers will begin to buy in other places because they will know that their customers are aware of certain things so that they will do good business. So that was the idea. But some people saw it and they were like, oh, I don't want to have diamonds anymore. And I was just like, no. Yeah, yeah. Buy it from us. You know. That was the idea. But also another thing is that was the idea of violence, right? So you see a lot of young people are taken by this idea of what violence is because they've never really suffered from it or experienced it. So they may have a fascination with it. So even the first book, A Long Way Gone, that's one of the points I wanted to make. There's nothing fascinating about violence at all. Nothing. And anybody who understands this, who has suffered through it deeply, would not glorify it in any way. So you have these rappers and these musicians that will talk about in their lyrics about this, I have this weapon and that weapon, I'm tough, I'm a gangster, and they don't even live in the neighborhoods that they are rapping about that are tough, right? So we took some of these guys to Sierra Leone. And mind you, the war had ended, but these guys were scared out of their minds, you know. And these are guys who would talk about all this, you know. So it was my job to translate the two cultures on the trip, and it was very, sometimes I was just, there's no other way to put it. These guys were sissies in a lot of ways, you know. So they had sort of built up this bravado about how tough they are, but they were scared out of their minds. So everywhere I had to tell them, no, it's fine, and anyway. You know, so it was just kind of a bit annoying at some point, but it was a worthwhile thing to see, you know. The end of the movie, it didn't really get cut the way most people wanted, but what came out, the end product, was, I think it did its job, so, yeah.
The mine in the movie looked like it was Dutch-owned. Are more of the mines government-owned, or at least benefiting Sierra Leone now?
Some are benefiting, some are still a bit in a precarious position. The one in the film actually was owned by a fellow. During the war in Sierra Leone, we had a mercenary group that came that was called Executive Outcomes. And they were hired to come in. It's sort of a branch from Blackwater. They were hired to come in by the government that was in power at the time to push the rebels, repel the rebels from the capital city. Now, when they arrived and the rebels said, well, we have more money than the government, we have more diamonds, they gave them and they... So pretty much they were just for the highest bidder. Whoever gave them money, they would do. And so when the war ended, some of the guys from that group stayed behind in Sierra Leone and claimed some areas and began to set up companies. So the one in the movie was actually the guy who was running was a guy from Executive Outcomes. I know him from the war. I'm not sure he remembered me, but I know him from the war. So you have some of these mines that are run by people. And also what happens in a post-war country is that when wars end, because the security system in the country is no longer the case, it's very safe in Sierra Leone, but right after the war ends, most people will not want to go to invest because they don't know whether the security. So you have a lot of companies who don't have very good records who will go and say, well, we can invest. But they're deliberately doing it because they know then they can set up a deal that's to their advantage, that's not to the advantage of the people, and then just sort of exploit even more, you know? So you have a lot of that in Sierra Leone at this point. But I really don't blame it on the companies. I blame it on our own leaders because they're the ones who are supposed to set up the standard through which our natural resources are extracted for the benefit of the people. So if they're able to withstand it, because there are other countries that have natural resources that are doing great. For example, Botswana is an example. You know, they set up how their natural resources are extracted so they can benefit their country, and it works. So, as everywhere, more so for us, we need good leaders to do some things in the interest of the people. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes. The question is, throughout the war, there were these moments that was sort of miraculous that I just survived. Why do I think that these miracles were? I really don't know. actually, when I was in the war, I didn't think they were things that saved my life. I used to believe that it's because I knew how to fight as a soldier. That's why I survived these things. But of course, in retrospect, I know that some of the things that I came out of, it had nothing to do with the fact that I knew how to fight, you know. There was something else at play. I don't know, but some of these moments were also very, you know, in the scheme of things, it's insignificant, you know. Sometimes what saved your life, you've heard the stories from the Holocaust as well, sometimes what saved your life is that you stop to do something completely irrational. Maybe you said, maybe I'm going to stop to just wash my face in the river and everybody gets gunned down and then you'll be like, oh, you know. Or maybe you stop to tie your shoes if you had one, or maybe you just sit around to eat something. It was just things that didn't really make any sense at all. But that's what war is. Now, I'm glad I survived, of course, but I'm not really sure. Maybe as I get older, I would discover why it is that I survived. But for now, I'm happy that I did and I'm standing here. Any other questions? Yes. So what are some of the key things to reintroduce a child back who's been traumatized into society, into sort of normalcy? Well, first of all, I think everybody's traumatized differently. And also it's based on what their lives had been before the war. So, for example, for a lot of young people who had a kind of family stability, who had had a sense of being loved or being a part of a community, they had a threshold, or some place where they can stand and spring from. And there are some who were not coming from that, so it was more difficult to form that for them. And some were born in the war, so they had no idea of what stability is. So you have to create that for them. And that sense comes by actually people who come into their lives, who genuinely love them and care for them selflessly. And children coming from any kind of trauma can know if you're genuine. They can sense you 5,000 miles away. If you're not, they would not be able to relate to you. So once they see that and they begin to have that sense of stability, believe in the goodness of other people again. But that doesn't come by easily. You know, they test. I tested, like the nurse, Esther, I would throw things at her. I would say things just to test whether she really was just somebody who was pretending to care for me. And I would do things that were very harsh, you know, and because I was trying to see whether this was somebody I could even allow myself to trust again. So there's that. So that stability, that family life to come back into you. And in addition to this, I believe the other one that really helps is opportunity. And when opportunity comes into young people's life or coming from trauma, from war particularly, they begin to find themselves again, to discover themselves, their humanity, their mind, that they are capable of other things besides the violence that they'd come to know. When I was in the war, if anybody would have told me that I would go to university, I can write, I probably would have shot them. It's the truth, because I would have thought they were mocking me, because I would have thought that was the only thing that was possible in my life. And I had gotten so used to it and normalized it and knew how to function in it that I didn't see anything possible. But when I began to have opportunities with this family stability, I began to have opportunities in my life, I began to discover my own mind, that I actually had certain things, so that allowed me to actually refocus some of the things that I'd learned from the war that are not necessarily negative, or refocus them, you know. And also, then I began to build newer memories because of these opportunities. And those memories eventually begin to compete with the traumatic memories themselves. One example I'll give, when I came out of the war, my connection to nature has changed tremendously because, you know, even though I grew up in the countryside, so when I came to the U.S. and I started living here, I made some friends in California and I went to see them and they said, oh, yeah, we're going hiking. And I said, no, because for me, going in the bush, deliberately deciding you're going to go in the bush for pleasure was kind of like crazy to me, you know. Because during the war, my association was only that you ran to the bush because you're running for your life to hide there. You didn't go there for pleasure, just to enjoy it. And then we went to work, they convinced me, and then at some point I was like, we're going to go back. So, yeah, we're going to camp in the bush. And I said, absolutely not. You know? You know, because to me it was also you slept in the bush because you were hiding from war, you know. But slowly I've been able to go and hike and camp. Now I can enjoy being in nature again. So when I think of nature, the first thing that comes up is not just the war. It's other memories that I've had with it, because I've been able to develop those. So also with opportunity and what happens in your life, you begin to build those things that then compete. And lastly, it takes time. It's not a quick fix. And everybody's time is different. And one tricky thing about trauma is that the physical wound from war or from any violence are the easiest one to heal because you can see them. The psychological ones, those are the ones that are most difficult and they are not visible at all. So they can go on for years, and everybody heals differently. What works for me will completely devastate somebody else. Some friends of mine, the way they want to heal from the war in Sierra Leone is to never, ever speak about it. And they will not tolerate any discussion, but that's their own way. And some people is to make joke about everything that happened, humor. This can also be medicine. You know, so there are various ways that people find their niche. But those two things actually are very key, in my opinion. Because that's what has happened to me, so, yeah. Yes?
You come from this beautiful oral tradition that you've been able to translate into words. I'd be interested in knowing what kind of books you read or what authors you read.
I read a lot. I think in my opinion, for anybody who wants to be a writer, you have to read a lot. Young people don't like hearing this, particularly. You know, when you're at university, they ask you, so how can I be a good writer? You should read a lot of books. You know, so. But so I read a lot. So I've read, of course, a lot of the classic African authors like Chinua Achebe, Wally Soyinka, and all of these other guys. But one of my favorite authors is actually J.M. Coetzee, South African writer. He's written a lot of books, but one of my favorite of his is something called Waiting for the Barbarians. And I like his work, so he's inspired me a lot. Of recent, I've been actually reading Kurt Vonnegut. I pick up some of a collection of his work, and this guy was brilliant. I mean, you know, so I discover things. So I read a lot of different things here and there. I also read a lot of contemporary things, like, you know, there's a young woman called Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She wrote like Half of a Yellow Sun and Americana and other books like that. And I was also recently reading this other young lady who wrote a book called We Need New Names, I think Nonviolet Bulawayo. So I tried to read things. And before I was reading Kurt Vonnegut, I read this book that I reread again, two books actually. One was Chinua Achebe's very early book. It's called Chick and the River. It was a very early book before he wrote Things Fall Apart. And I read this book when I was a kid. And so I found it at some old bookstore, so I was able to start reading it. And also this woman called Carrie Hume, she's called The Bone People. She's from New Zealand. Yeah, she's from New Zealand. So I find things from all over the place, and I read them, and I, you know, so I just discover and things. You know. I read a lot, pretty much. So if anybody has any suggestions, tell me later. I'll make it down. I like to discover new things as well. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Actually, my Sarah, my publisher, and I were discussing this Time article as we were walking here. Yes, I am.
I just wondered if you're going to tell stories again orally.
Yes, of course. I will tell stories to my child. I'll be a father. I'm very, very excited about it. I will definitely tell stories to my child. Orally, I would read some to her, but mostly I would tell her stories from my childhood that I heard as a child growing up. And also, I would, you know, of course, my grandmother would also tell some more stories to this child. So this child has no choice but to listen to. They have no choice. She will probably hear some stories over and over again, like I was as a child. Like, oh, I've heard that. I don't want to hear it again. But, you know, the thing about stories is that, you know, when I was a kid, they would tell you stories and they would tell you, which I believe now, which I'll try to impart into my children, that story is medicine. That is given to you to strengthen your resolve, your character, your spirit, so that you can it will be useful to you when you need it. When life throws certain things at you, some stories will become relevant to you. And so they will tell you all kinds of stories, and you will be like, why are you telling me this one? And one of the stories actually that I end the memoir with, Long Way Gone, is one of these stories. You know, when I was a boy, I heard this story quite a lot, and at the end of the war, I heard it again, and then I realized why they had told us this story. It took me throughout the war to understand. When I was a boy, sit around the fire again, and your mom and your dad were there, and they would tell you this story. There was a hunter who goes into the bush to hunt. He had a rifle, was walking the bushes, and he was looking for animals, and then he saw a monkey, so he raised his rifle to shoot the monkey. He was ready, and then the monkey spoke and said, oh, hold on, what are you doing? You know, like, you know, said, you know, if you shoot me, your mother will die, and if you don't, your father will die. And they will ask you in front of your parents, so what would you do? I always say, yeah, I need to go to the bathroom, so I didn't have to answer the question. I can't hold it anymore. Be like, yeah, you come back and you answer the question. You know. And some people will say, well, we'll go hunting other animals that do not speak back to human beings and things like that, you know. But it took me till after the war to understand what that story meant, which was really the idea of what the consequence of violence is. Once you embark on it, there's a consequence that you're not going to like. Once you raise a fist to hit somebody, once you raise a weapon, there's a consequence that you're not going to like, and it's not going to be an easy one. And when I was a kid, I would always think, why are they telling us this story? It makes no sense. Why would we decide? You know, anyway. So as a father, this is what I would do. I would impart stories in my child so that she'll be strengthened by the knowledge and wisdom of her people, my people, so that she'll be able to walk through life with a strong character, hopefully. I'll do the best that I can, I think. That's all I can promise her. Yes, any other questions? Anybody has any questions? Yes.
Also, a teacher in our
Yes, I listen mostly to old school and underground stuff. Hip-hop, rap music is not what it used to be, unfortunately. It's quite terrible nowadays. Especially the ones that people hear on the radio, you know. There's almost this fear now that if you play anything that's conscious, that's gonna make people think, nobody would want to listen to it on the radio. So they put things that are not necessarily... So you have to search for things that are more meaningful. But I grew up listening to American hip-hop. This is one of my connections, actually, to the American culture. It came through hip-hop music, but also through this Peace Corps volunteer guy who lived in our village, you know. And we sort of... However this guy behaved is how we thought all Americans were. So when you send these guys, we have to be careful. Because whatever I do, we're like, yeah, that's how Americans. For example, he would wear these jeans and shoes for months. He would not wash them. They would be really dirty, you know. So then people came out with this expression, whenever you wore your clothes and they were dirty, you didn't wash them. Oh, yeah, you're wearing it like Peace Corps style, you know, or like American style, you know. It was like, you're wearing the American style. That's the way the Americans do it. Don't wash it, you know. So it was funny. So these are some of, but then hip-hop was another thing, you know. So back in the day, you know, they had the MC Hammer, we'd do the Running Man in our village, you know, and our parents didn't like it very much. But we enjoyed it. I still enjoy it, you know, just the expression of it, I think, is still something that's quite remarkable. Thank you so much, and I would sit somewhere, I'm sure, to sign the books right there. Yeah. Thank you for coming, and thank you for your time.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.